Yeah, I like your idea of making a safe space. So at that point, I refrain from whipping beanie babies at people, but only for a brief moment.
I know that's really hard for you.
Yeah. Hello, you've reached Hotline Design Podcast. How may we help you? And welcome back to Hotline Design Podcast. In this week's episode, we bring you the second episode in our two-part series on the double diamond design process. Like a second marriage, we're getting down on one knee and presenting you with yet another diamond for your collection. Let's dive deeper into the gleaming, the shining, the multi-carat, develop and deliver. So ladies, I have to know, how have your weeks been?
I really wish I had a way to kind of look into your brain and figure out how you make up these like connections. They're brilliant.
Many marriages. People don't know this about me, but I've been married 5 times.
Oh my God. It shows.
Is that one of the things you go to when you play like 2 truths and 1 lie? And then no one can tell that that's actually the lie?
That I'm a divorcee many times over.
Oh my God, honestly, it's so good. Yeah, your question. I don't have a great update this week. I mean, it is great, but not like interesting, I guess. So I've mainly focused on work. So this week, my client, we were working on a checkout process. And I don't know, like, I think for UX designers out there, it might be a bit of a surprise that I've been in the industry for 4 years now, and this is my first checkout process. And it's generally because we used to do a lot of enterprise UX, so commercial websites weren't necessarily what I used to touch, but I really enjoyed it. And the cool thing about commercial websites as well is that there are so many kind of best practices and great examples out there in comparison to enterprise UX. So it wasn't too big of a challenge, to be perfectly honest, but it was great to kind of get to do that as a first time. But yeah, that's me. How's your week, Ethan?
Yeah, not too bad. It's a bit of a short week for me because, you know, we had the Easter break and then I decided to take Tuesday off as well. So yeah, 3-day week. But it's been quite good just getting back into the swing of things after Easter. You know, it's always a bit challenging after a long holiday, but thankfully, I probably didn't mention last week when we recorded the other episode, but I've actually been up north for a while in the countryside just with my boyfriend's family, and it's been really nice just going out for walks as the days get longer, and we've had a couple of nice days last week as well, so I was just going out on a lot of walks, trying to enjoy the fresh air in the countryside. Yeah, so quite a chilled one for me, I think. Not too bad. Yeah, not that many updates, actually. But then again, you know, we're still coming out of lockdown, so hopefully not too surprising. What about you, Lauren?
Yeah, well, you said I loved all the cow content you were posting of all the cute cows outside of Manchester. They're just absolutely adorable. But on my end, for those of you keeping score at home, I still do not have a table yet. So I'm really getting a lot of use out of my little TV dinner trays. And also, I've been working on something kind of fun, which is planning a virtual hen do for a friend. So kind of looking at like DIY kits that I can send, because I've got an added challenge of having to account for attendees being in Australia, the US, and the UK thus far. There might be others added from elsewhere around the globe. The bride is a truly international gem. So yeah, it's proving a little bit difficult, but we're making it work. I've been trying to order cupcakes in Waco, Texas, and every time I go through the checkout stage, some error appears that like I'm not allowed to order American cupcakes. So yeah, the struggle is real. I don't know why Waco, Texas hates me, but especially the cupcake industry, they are not willing to take my money. So. And then on a work front, I've actually started a new project. It's always fun coming into a project well into, you know, a handful of sprints and having to meet people. And then they're like, oh, by the way, Lauren, here's a list of a billion things to do without any context. So it's always a bit of a struggle, but the hustle is real and we keep going.
So for those keeping score at home, previously on last week's episode, we've been talking about the first diamond of the double diamond. And if you remember, that diamond is encompassed of, is that a word? Is that? Okay, great.
Comprised
of? It has two parts. First one, discover. So that kind of allows for divergent thinking. And then the second one, define, which allows for a bit of more convergent thinking, a bit of critical thinking. But in this week's episode, we will be talking about develop and deliver. So if we look at the two diamonds of the double diamonds, the first one, discover and define, is all about designing the right thing. And this week we're going to talk about designing the things right. So again, as a recap, the first diamond centers around finding the problems worth solving. So just making sure that we aren't just looking at the symptoms of a problem, and we kind of dig really deep through our research and find out the real needs of people. And then the second phase makes sure that we are creating some great solutions for them and solving their problems. But yeah, thank you. And now on to the main content.
Or are we going on to the main content? So I just want to jump in with a diamond divergent as a divorcee five times over. As I was researching for the show notes, I got sidetracked into all that glitters. And I have some fun facts on the largest diamonds in the world, other than, you know, the double diamonds, which really do take the cake in our heart. But we've got the Cullinan diamonds, which are the largest gem quality rough diamonds ever found, and they weighed 3,106.75 carats. And for reference, Princess Diana's like blue sapphire in the middle of that ring that now Kate has is 12 carats. And so this diamond was discovered at the Cullinan Mines in South Africa in 1905. And then it was subsequently gifted to King Edward. And then it was such a massive diamond that you couldn't really like do anything with it. So it had to be cut down into smaller sizes. And so the biggest two chunks of this like massive diamond actually make up the diamonds in the British Royal Scepter and the British Crown. And fun fact, like it's such a massive diamond and is so much bigger than even kind of like the second largest diamond that transporting it was like a big to-do. So there was a decoy that was sent in the safe of a ship right around the captain that was like guarded 24/7 by security on this ship. And then the real one, just to really like ensure that no one really knew where it was or that no one could intercept it. But the real one was sent in an unmarked box through the regular post, which like, I don't know, British Post is actually pretty good. But like, if this was sent through Canada Post, it would never have gone there. You would have lost a priceless diamond. So I guess people had a lot of faith in the real post in 1905. But yeah, it was sent through and then it was made into kind of all the royal gemstones and shines bright to this day.
If you want some reliable post, move to the UK.
Yeah. Like that to me is insane. Like let's put this like priceless world's largest diamond in the post.
I know. That's crazy. Like, what a huge risk to be taking. Yeah. But, you know, I guess in 1905, I guess maybe people wouldn't have intercepted the post as much. Or, yeah, it's quite a smart trick.
Yeah.
Yeah, a good thing. Yeah. It's quite a smart thing to do, actually. If
you think it's kind of like things are safest in plain sight.
That's true.
Anyways, back to regular scheduled programming.
Yeah, thank you so much for that historical segment. I love it when we drop gems into our podcast like that. And hopefully it provides a nice break from all of the design first content that we talk about on this podcast. So bringing it back to the double diamond though, last week we covered the first part of that diamond. And this week we're going to start from the divergent part of the second diamond again, which is develop. And develop is really the stage where as a group, we try and think of as many possible ideas based on the existing user research and insights we've gathered. And one way we often do this is we try and reframe the problem as a how might we statement. And we often start these problem statements with how might we, just because it's a really open-ended question, by using the word how. And then might represents all of the different possibilities that we can come up with. And then we as well is an inclusive first person pronoun. So we really try and get everyone in the group in a single room, or I guess on a collaborative tool, since we're working online nowadays. And we essentially put out lots of different how might we statements. So for example, rather than restrict ourselves to specific solutions, I know Lavinia, you talked about the order checkout process just now, we could come up with solutions to improve the order checkout process by starting with the how might we statement. How might we improve the order checkout process, rather than saying something very narrow, like how might we ensure that the user spends less time on the checkout process, because in that second statement, we're already suggesting a potential solution. So keeping how might we statements really broad is one way where we can try and get as many ideas as possible from the rest of the group. Once we've done that ideate phase where we come with as many ideas as possible through a brainstorming process, as part of this, we can also use something called a creative matrix to help us categorize our ideas into different themes or categories. So for example, we know that some of the solutions we're going to come up with involve, you know, working with people or ensuring collaboration between people. Then one of the sub-themes we can have as we come up with statements is to think about any people solutions. Or if we know that our product is very digital focused and we want to focus on making specific digital changes or features to our product, then we can kind of fit that within the category of digital solutions. So sometimes coming up with a creative matrix is also a really good way to come up with as many solutions as possible, but also taking into account sort of business constraints or the sorts of tools or types of solutions that we can come up with. And after coming up with as many ideas as possible, we can then start to evaluate these ideas. And so now we've got, you know, a how might we question that we're trying to tackle, as well as some hypothetical answers that the whole group has collaboratively come up with. So that pretty much sums up the develop phase. And I just have a question for everyone. So what are some of your go-to activities to run within the develop phase?
Yeah, I feel like you already gave a really, really good kind of overview of the some of the best activities. The only thing that I kind of enjoy doing that maybe wasn't mentioned. So last year, Spotify came up with a new kind of framework that is called the Thoughtful Execution Framework. And one of the things they do is they basically come up with the how might we questions. And before they jump into solutions, they actually come up with hypotheses. And that word is always very difficult for me to say, so I hope I said it right.
Nailed it.
But for example, I think one of the, when you kind of were explaining the how might we questions, the example you gave was how might we make people spend less time during the checkout. And in order to keep things broad, to not necessarily solutionize just yet, and encourage them to give hypotheses instead that make it clear that they might not necessarily be implemented and that they will be tested and prototyped and iterated upon in the next stage. And I think that makes things really clear and avoids kind of the syndrome of people solutionizing and getting attached to their solutions. So for example, to kind of the how might we example you gave about kind of keeping people in the checkout process less, one of the hypotheses that someone can come up with can be something like adding Google Pay and Apple Pay to the checkout process will cut the checkout process time in half. Or you can put things like adding a postcode lookup will make the checkout shorter and things like that. And these are kind of already tested and we already know the answers and that tends to be the truth. But if you have like a more challenging how might we question that you haven't necessarily tackled in the past, or you don't know that people have tackled in the past, coming up with these hypotheses can be really useful. And I think it encourages people from different departments and different part of kind of like the organization to come up with hypotheses that are probably more personal to them. And it gives you a better idea of how people see the problem. So that's mine.
I think for develop, and this can play into a lot of different activities around ideate, I always like to encourage people to draw. So I find in doing that, one, it's a fun icebreaker when they kind of present it back, like to see everyone's like drawings, and people are quite sheepish about their doodles, and it is just kind of like a fun kind of team building exercise. But I think it forces people to kind of get their ideas down on paper. It's great for visual learners. It also provides like outputs, so you can kind of get your ideas all up on like a board and kind of congregate around them. And in actually drawing it out, you might kind of notice things you should be adding or additional things to consider. So pen to paper, I think, is just really a powerful tool through and through in ideation.
Yeah, I love that actually. That just jogs my memory because one thing I feel works really well for the ideate stage or the develop phase is Crazy Eights, and it's just such a cheap and easy way of getting people to jot down their ideas. And so for people who don't know, or for those of you keeping score at home, as Lauren would say, Crazy Eights is essentially where you get everyone to come up with 8 ideas within a pretty short span of time. So on average, it's like 1 minute per idea. And what you can do is just kind of fold a piece of paper. Is it 3 times? Yeah, 3 times, isn't it? 3 times. So down the middle, then down the middle, and then in half again. And essentially, you just put a stopwatch on and everyone gets 1 minute to draw out each idea. I mean, we do encourage people to draw, but if people are really reticent to, we normally don't force them. But we try and just get people to, you know, either draw a feature that they like or even draw like a storyboard to explain their idea. And that act of putting pen to paper is actually so fun because I think people get super involved and bought in. And it just, I think the sheer like number of ideas you have to come up with within a short span of time just encourages people to come up with as many ideas as possible. So it's a great way of canvassing like tons of ideas across the board.
And I love the descent of seeing like the first Crazy Eight is like drawn out beautifully. It's like a solid idea. And then like the last one is just like panic scribbles. Like people usually run out of ideas kind of like after like 4, at least in my camp. So the last one is always like just kind of like for the bands. It's like a bit of comedic relief, I find.
I love that. On kind of like your note, Yusin, of like encouraging people to draw when they're a bit reticent and stuff like that, do you have any favorite ways to kind of encourage people to ideate in general, to kind of give their all?
I think it's quite important to kind of set the tone by saying that, you know, every idea is a good idea. I think it's that usual refrain of saying that no idea is a stupid one. And that just generally helps people keep their guard down. And, you know, I think just letting them know that the intention at this stage is not to come up with ideas that are super polished. It's really just to hear from everyone and kind of democratize that design process. Another thing that I find works really well is in a couple of workshops that I ran when I was part of our innovation team, which I might have mentioned before, is we try and give people inspiration before they actually come up with ideas. And what we do is, you know, depending on the how might we statement, we might pull up a list of inspiration cards or like cool examples or just things that people are inspired by, right? Maybe asking them, what are you inspired by? And then showing them examples of products that they like. And I think other parts of their life into this whole workshopping process. So that's what I find pretty useful. But I don't know about you both.
Yeah, I like your idea of making a safe space. So at that point, I refrain from whipping beanie babies at people.
I know that's really hard for you.
But only for a brief moment.
I was going to add, on top of kind of like making sure that people know that no idea is a bad idea, what I also like to do is to kind of frame criticism as well in a way. So make sure that everyone in the room understands that if they want to kind of add on to an idea or maybe even poke holes in it, which is not necessarily encouraged at this stage, but if they do that, that it's always kind of constructive, and it's not something that's personal, and that is that everyone in the room also knows that it's being brought up because we want to come up with the best ideas. So just kind of, I know it sounds corny, but just creating that safe space where people feel kind of very open and allowed to come up with any ideas, and they also feel safe enough to know that if their idea is being criticized, it comes from a place of positivity. It's not necessarily because someone thinks that is a bad idea. And the other thing I like is to potentially start with ideating alone at the start. I find, at least myself, that I find that it's a lot of pressure when it's like, everyone, come with your best ideas, blah, blah, blah. And I feel a bit like, it's a lot of pressure. But if it's just me and a few post-it notes for the first 5 minutes, then I feel like I am more kind of, I'm less likely to kind of refrain myself from putting down an idea on a post-it note. And then if I'm not comfortable with sharing it, then I can just like not share that post-it note. But it allows me to just put everything down from my brain before I kind of share it with everyone. And I think that works for other people as well.
Yeah, so much better than calling everyone up to the podium immediately and saying, share your idea, and then we're going to do the kind of like Roman Emperor thumbs up. Adultmocracy is also like a good way to kind of even refine these a bit further. In a way that I guess like is quite positive and it is quite anonymous, and where you just have like a couple dot stickers, maybe like three, and you can vote on your favorite post-it just by putting dots on. Though I would say people are quite likely to get biased based on other post-its that they see have dots on them.
Yeah, it's kind of like the focus group problem as well, I guess, when other people influence others. Cool, so we basically talked about the develop stage. So this is the stage where we encourage divergence and we encourage people come up with ideas and so on. But after we've done that, we basically have to prioritize exactly what we're going to put into practice. So this here comes the another kind of like convergence stage, and that is deliver. And this is all about kind of implementation. For people that are very kind of hands-on, this is probably the most enjoyable part of the process, because this is where we prototype, this is where we test, we analyze, we kind of bring those prototypes to people, get their feedback, we learn, we iterate based on the feedback. Very often, this is where we work most closely with developers. I will say here that we encourage everyone in the team to be part of every stage, but we do know that some organizations kind of aren't set up to allow everyone's time to be part of every stage. So if this is the stage where you start working with your developers, I would really encourage that you put some time in to kind of talk them through what came out in the previous stages of the Double Diamond. But yeah, this is where we kind of, all of that work comes into practice, and you have hopefully an MVP by the end of it that you release. And I will say also that this is not exactly the last stage. When Lauren was kind of doing the research for this, she put some great visuals in our Notion for us. But after deliver, there is actually evolve as well. So after you release that MVP, you are going to track the learnings and celebrate the achievements and make sure that you understand what didn't work as well and kind of iterate based on it as well. But yeah, this is the most practical stage, the deliver stage.
I love the idea of evolve as well. I just picture like Pokemon variations of your product that you've delivered. Mm-hmm. And just like the first one being like a little baby Squirtle, and then the second one being the more tricked out Squirtle, because ultimately I don't know enough about Pokemon to make this reference.
I don't know anything about Pokemon either.
Doesn't Squirtle evolve into Bulbasaur or something like that eventually?
No, Bulbasaur is like an entirely different Pokemon. I know, like, doesn't Eve turn into Ninetales? That might be the third iteration. Does Pokemon have
three? Yeah, like, Pokemon fans, please don't hate us if we get this wrong. I mean, I do love Pokemon, but it's
been... In fact, please write in.
Yeah, true.
Yeah. Please hold us accountable, Pokemon community.
Yes.
I also really like the idea of evolve, because if you think about, also, like, sorry, but tying this back to your portfolios, like, whenever you write your case study, it's always that bit at the end which, you know, says, like, learnings and what would you do differently next time. And evolve is kind of like that, right? Essentially, the MVP is not meant to be the be-all and end-all. Like Nicole actually said in our previous episode as well, you know, the point is to kind of develop a product that's sufficient, that has enough features that you can kind of test the core features with your users. And then the idea is just to try and, like, capture any points you would change and just keep, like, iterating and working on that prototype. So really it's an iterative process. So I actually had a question on this stage, which was, we've talked a lot about delivering minimum viable products, but how do you select features for MVPs?
I feel like this question was actually asked of me a lot in interviews when I was interviewing before I changed jobs. And what I liked to say was that I take a look back at the research and I kind of rank the problems that people have spoken to us about. So often I feel like when you talk to people, even before you kind of get into the insights stage, there are some issues that come up a lot. So, like, if you, let's say, talk to 10 people, there often is one thing that 8 people have actually told you about. And then another thing that, like, 6 people told you about. And then there are a few that were mentioned once or twice. And based on that, I feel like you get a sense of what needs to be tackled first. So I kind of make a list of the things that people have mentioned over and over, or the things that have created kind of, like, almost, it sounds very deep, but, like, the most pain in people, like, processes that have really kind of taken a toll on maybe even their health, or, like, how they approach work and things like that. There are so many things that people kind of mention. So yeah, I tend to look at how many people mentioned a specific problem and how much kind of distress a problem might have caused someone, and take those, put them in the MVP. And all of the things that people mention as, like, oh, it would be great to have this, or, oh, this has happened to me once, I tackle after the MVP.
Such a great answer, Lavinia. I feel like you could almost adapt the rainbow chart to serve that purpose. You could have the rainbow chart of pain.
Yeah.
Which kind of goes through and talks about, like, the frequency that something is mentioned, and then even, like, within the cell you could assign, like, an ABCD to it to, like, really resonate with, you know, how much of a pain point this was for someone or how severe it was. So yeah, rainbow of pain.
You're saying rainbow of pain, that is really catchy. I don't think I'll ever think about rainbows in the same way again. Haha, rhyme.
Never enjoy another rainbow.
Yeah, that's something I've been thinking a lot about recently, because this almost veers into product manager territory if you think about it. Like, is it also your job as the UX designer to be selecting features for MVPs, or is this something that you work together with the rest of your team on? Because everyone should ultimately have an input on, you know, how easy it is to build certain features, right, in your backlog. And I think what we've done in the previous project is we had a user journey, and we essentially kind of went through all of the key stages within that user journey, or the key features that mapped onto each part of the user journey. And then as a group, basically kind of did dot voting on which features we would like to build up for the MVP. I think another way we can kind of do this is by probably coming up with some sort of backlog, like in Excel, right? So super traditional, not my favorite tool, but it works well enough. And then just thinking about kind of the complexity and the value of each feature, or almost having a sort of, like, matrix that you can prioritize things on. And then I think that's one of the ways in which we try and prioritize things for the MVP. And ultimately, I think, maybe going back to my earlier point, I think it's quite important to get other members of the team involved as well, especially the developers, who are so crucial to building out the product and making sure that, you know, the functionality works. So it's something that I often like to kind of get other members of the team involved in, and then kind of jointly prioritize these features together on a matrix, or just kind of scanning through an Excel backlog and deciding on that as a group.
Mm-hmm. Or even Jira story points are really good in terms of categorizing it. If you also have a phobia of Excel.
Welcome to the club.
Yes. Welcome to the support group.
About MVPs, this is going to be very much of a leading question. So researchers out there, I'm sorry. And non-researchers, please don't do this. But what are your thoughts on how we deliver MVP? The reason why I'm asking is because I've been in teams before where we said we were delivering an MVP, but it was such a big product, really. It was so convoluted and there were so many things that really didn't need to be part of an MVP and almost were in the way of us being able to get the right insights into how to improve some of the parts that were important for an MVP. I find that, at least where we used to be, people got the idea of an MVP and they liked how it sounded, like, oh, minimum viable product, or we're gonna do just kind of like what we need to do and we're gonna go and test it. But realistically, we would spend like a year on something and not get any insights and be like, this is the MVP. And yeah, I feel like definitely we weren't doing it right. And I'm sorry for the leading part of my question, but what has been your experience on this?
Yeah, no worries. I think almost to your point, there needs to be another term to describe MVP for when it's like not
maximum
really
viable
MVP,
product.
Yeah, and so many. Yeah, it's like medium viable product because it definitely is not like bare bones and there might not be that element of testing. I also think to really do a real MVP, you need to, because you're working so closely with very specific features, I think there really does need to be that opportunity to kind of take the step back, look at what you've worked on as a whole and assess, you know, what's the next piece you need for that minimum viable product, not medium viable product. Because I think when you're working so close on one feature, then you're like, oh, well, the next thing is like this small feature, which branches off.
Oh, how about
we
add this as well?
Exactly. It's so easy to just kind of have your like your shopping basket and just keep throwing things in like you're hungry at the supermarket. So I think in the retrospective, it's really an opportunity to look back, see the entire thing, like as though it's a train, see what cars are missing for that first level. And then ultimately you can focus on making it like that double decker train with the medium viable product.
Love all the references.
Yeah, these are some great analogies. There was just something I wanted to add as well, because I came across this a while ago, and speaking of food related analogies, like, you know, going to the supermarket and shopping, I came across this thing called the hot potato process, which I think really encapsulates the whole designer developer handoff process really well. And this is probably something we've talked about in the past on other episodes as well. You know, I think a lot of the time designers feel that sometimes developers don't necessarily do justice to the beautiful prototypes that they've designed, and developers often feel like they're being told what to do by the designers without much clear direction. And I think the hot potato process actually kind of challenges this. So traditionally, a lot of people think, okay, we need to design everything and get it to a really, really good place before we hand this off to the developers. So it needs to be super high fidelity. You know, we need to make everything pixel perfect, and we need to document everything in the prototype itself. And using collaboration tools like Figma certainly helps with that, but this also puts an insane amount of pressure, I think, on the designer to make sure that everything is perfect, and also just assumes that the designer can just hand everything off to the developer, and then the developer is going to go away and work their magic. But it doesn't always work like that, because it's almost like passing a hot potato, right? Kind of dropping it to the developer, and then the developer kind of putting, kind of passing it back to the designer. So it's a sort of like iterative process where maybe the designer works on one design, shows it to the developer. The developer then builds anything based on the designs and then showcases it back to the designer. So I think probably rather than think about two separate stages of design and then development handoff, it's more, how should I say this? It's more of, you know, a short burst of design work, then development work, then design work, then development work. So, the hot potato process is mentioned on this designer's blog. His name is Dan Moore, and what he says is really key to this is designers and developers having really good communication, and you can do that by setting up time to work together. So as a designer, you know, you can try and put some time into the developer's diary just to walk them through what you've designed so far, and just have these frequent collaborative check-ins where you're kind of working together side by side. And that's probably a really good approach I think I'm definitely going to use whenever I embark on the deliver process. And within my current project at the moment, that's something I'm trying to do because I know I'm going to have a lot of stuff to deliver. And I was actually really stressed about it the other day. But then I had a chat with my developer and he was like, listen, you know, you just need to give me the wireframes and, you know, maybe flesh out some features. But then what I'll do is I'll just use these as specs to start building the actual functional prototypes. And then we can have frequent calls to just kind of play that back and make sure that things are going according to the design, rather than making sure that everything is perfect in the design on the first pass. Because, you know, ultimately it's not the finished high fidelity prototypes that we're going to deliver to the client, but the actual developed product. So yeah, I just thought it'd be quite useful to throw that in there.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I definitely have been in so many situations where there was no hot potato and it was just like, these are the designs and the developer would create them and I would see them and I would be like, what is that? No.
Cold potato.
No, please throw the potato back. We need to. And this is not necessarily their fault. Like, definitely probably parts of the design weren't technically feasible, or, but it was probably that lack of communication that now we know a lot more about. But I guess at the start of your career, you kind of just assume, oh, I'll just give them the designs. There you go. Here's your Zeppelin link. But yeah, I wish I knew about that then. It's a really cool concept and I really like it.
Yeah. It's not like a linear conveyor belt. It's actually a circular
exactly.
one.
And I think it like builds the collaboration muscle between design and development, which often I feel like needs to be more. Yeah, we need more of that.
And on the point of kind of, yeah, like making it work and kind of changing these processes so that they actually like are quite feasible. I just want to talk about flexibility of the double diamond. So the way the double diamond is like physically drawn is, yeah, two diamonds, the discover and define being the first diamond, and then the develop and the deliver being the second diamond. And they're drawn as like equal lengths, implying that you should spend kind of equal time on all of these phases. But I don't think that's necessarily right. And that might not work for your particular kind of situation or project. So for instance, if your brief is kind of more focused on problem framing, you could have a really stretched out first phase of the diamond and kind of the discovery and define area. Or if you're trying to solve like a more aesthetic problem, like to make, you know, an existing kettle like more aesthetic or more beautiful, then like the second diamond of the develop and the deliver would be expanded. So when using the process, realize that you can kind of customize it and personalize it to work for your various project, and that you don't have to stick to the rigid time frames of like equal time for each phase.
I absolutely love it. And I think based on the question that we had last week, where it was like, oh, double diamond is quite theoretical, like how do you actually apply it? I think this is a really good point even for then. I hope they're still listening.
Alex from Australia, are you still listening?
Yeah, I think this is a really good way to be like, look, figure out exactly what you need to do and then kind of apply it based on your needs. And also because we mentioned friend of the pod Albert Einstein last week, we need to mention him again because he dropped some wisdom related to this as well. And he said, if I had an hour to solve a problem and my life depended on the solution, I would spend the first 55 minutes determining the proper question to ask. For once I know the proper question, I could solve the problem in less than 5 minutes. So that's related to kind of like the what you need to actually do. So if it's about kind of understanding the problem and framing it, then maybe the first 55 minutes need to be dedicated to that.
Yeah, one long diamond followed by the small diamond. Albert's making it work for him, and he will not apologize for that.
Love it.
Speaking of not apologizing, we've got a Hotline Design Hotline question for this week.
Hey gals, I'm Dragos, a long-time listener, first-time caller. In my day-to-day, I'm a senior developer and a UX enthusiast. I've used this double diamond method before in other teams, but I'm not sure everyone in the team was so enthusiastic about it. Do you have any advice on how to sell the process to the rest of the team, who aren't designers?
I think the first thing I would love to do in that situation is to understand what the reservations about the process are and addressing those. I will make an assumption here that often I think, based on my experience, the part of the diamond that gets the most kind of pushback is probably the first diamond. It's the research phase and obviously the insights that we're kind of taking from the research. Often people who aren't designers, and this is a huge generalization, like everyone, please don't be offended, but they're very excited about solving a problem, so they jump straight into a solution, which would basically be the second diamond, kind of completely ignoring the first one. So I think often it's just a old age problem of evangelizing research, just making people understand that if we have a great common understanding of the problem, then we're more likely to come up with a great solution that will really work for our users, and not only our users, obviously for the business as well. But yeah, I guess I just based on my assumption that is what people's reservations about the problems are, that's what I would do.
Yeah, I would definitely be inclined to agree with that. I feel that often when you get pushback, it's because people don't think that the upfront stages of doing all the user research and, you know, maybe coming up with ideas are as important, because maybe they kind of naturally look to you as a UX designer to have that intuition already without needing to do user research. And I think I would try and play it by ear, because ultimately, you know, I think user research is really, really important and something we always need to do. But perhaps rather than kind of spend, you know, equal amounts of time in user research and on the second diamond, you know, like develop and deliver, you, like Lauren, you know, like you said earlier on, you know, the double diamond is quite a flexible process, so you can really flex the amount of time spent on each stage. And I think maybe that's what I would try to do when planning out my approach. I would definitely try and include user research where possible or work with what we have, but maybe just kind of cut that stage down a little bit in accordance with what your stakeholders want or need, just to be a bit more flexible and try and sell this process to them. The other thing I would do is, you know, if they are still quite reluctant to let you spend that much time on the upfront process of really running that research to get insights, then it might be a good way to kind of showcase the value of running this user research to them by using metrics, because I feel particularly with more senior stakeholders or maybe the rest of your team, sometimes they ultimately want to know like what the impact of running that user research is, like why is this useful? And it can be a good practice to, whenever you run user research, just kind of pull out some metrics or kind of think about what the impact on the business would be. And then just, you know, try and sell user research by saying, if we were to implement these changes, then, you know, we'd be able to maybe improve our sort of like customer experience score or our net promoter score by this much. And I think just really trying to showcase the importance of user research by relying on numbers and metrics is a good way to try and convince people about the usefulness of some of these upfront parts of the double diamond process. Mm.
Yeah, thanks for your question, Dragos. I would say that a double diamond sounds quite abstract, and it sounds like something you can buy at Tiffany's. So if you are in person and you've got kind of like one of those mother walls or like a place that you can put artifacts, I would say print off the double diamond process, put it up there. And if people are a bit more logical and maybe don't lean towards like metaphors or visualization, I would also, as suggested in the previous episode, break it down into a checklist. Like Lavinia mentioned, just even if you kind of write down the stages, you put like a little checkbox beside, you might even change the language a bit so that it explains kind of in a small paragraph what you're doing at each stage. I think that can be a really powerful tool, because it sounds, yeah, like a hippie idea, a double diamond. It's like, I need to charge my crystals in the pale moonlight. So some people might just be confused what that means. Also just kind of breaking it down to people when you're talking about it into discover, define, develop, and deliver is a lot more tangible. And thank you so much for your question, Dragos. And if anyone else has a question, please feel free to submit it at anchor.fm/hotlinedesignpod. And that just about does it for our two-part series. You are now equipped with two giant gemstones, and you can go forth and share your sparkle and shine and your knowledge of the double diamond design process. And you can find us on Instagram at hotlinedesignpod, and as always at Gmail at hotlinedesignpod@gmail.com. Thank you so much to the Ultimate Gems, and we'll catch you next week.
We're sorry. You have reached a number that has been disconnected. Please check the number and try your call again.